Hello and welcome to Conversations on Purpose. I'm Daniela Harkins.
And I'm Chad Hickey. And in each episode, we will be sitting down with industry leaders to have honest conversations around their process to find purpose in their professional and personal lives.
We will explore the topics we often think about but don't talk about in public, like being vulnerable in the workplace, embracing diversity, overcoming feeling like an imposter, and leading while remaining human.
Purpose is essential to today's leader. So let's start the conversation.
Hey, Chad, how's it going?
Good. Doing good. I want to ask you a random question before we get into our topic, and it's going to be super out of left field, but okay. I want to know if I'm like late to the party on this. So okay. Are you a music lover?
I like music.
Like or you love? So you must not be a music lover, or you would have been like, I love music.
Well, I mean, I love music, but I'm not like the type of person that knows obscure music and knows every technology.
Okay, but Tina Turner?
Yeah, I love Tina Turner.
Okay, have you heard the song Typical Male?
I don't know if I have or not. Maybe.
You need to listen to it. Listeners, go out there and listen to it. I've never heard it before in my life. And I've been on this Tina Turner kick. And I just have listened to it constantly all day. And I don't know why. And it's very 80s. So if you're not an 80s person, then
you didn't ask me if I love the 80s.
Well,
because I love the 80s.
It reminds me of something that would have been in the movie Mannequin. That's all I'll say.
Andrew McCarthy, one of my favorite actors of all time.
Cattrall.
Wait a second. Right.
Yes.
Now you're getting the reaction you probably wanted when you asked if I was a music lover, but yeah. Now you're getting the reaction because you brought up the 80s.
Well, there you go. So everyone go out there and listen to it. You will love the song.
So I think that Simply the Best and the couple of scenes from Schitt's Creek, if anybody's watched Schitt's Creek, I feel like that has brought Tina Turner back into the front of everything because of that show.
One of the best scenes of that show.
I know. So we just learned that I have a passion for the 80s, which means big hair, neon, shoulder pads. Like if it's big, I love it.
Okay.
But I feel like I'm going to turn this around on you for a minute because I feel like the topic today is very much a passion of yours as well. Here's what I'm going to say. I have no courage when it comes to being an entrepreneur. I am okay relying on somebody else for my paycheck and providing value that way. And today's topic is really kind of near and dear to your heart.
Well, yeah. I mean, listen, I think that when you are going through the process of starting and building and running your own company, there are things that I think when I was starting that process, things that people didn't say to me that then I started to experience. And then when I would go back to them and say, oh, did you have that? They're like, oh yeah, that's totally normal. But no one really talked about it.
So like you feel like, oh my gosh, I'm going through all of this. Am I crazy? Is this normal?
Right.
And then you find a network of people, right? That can help you.
Yeah. I mean, listen, when you're the CEO of a company, you have to maintain a certain level of external control, right? Like if your employees see that you are shaken, that can have other effects on your business.
So
I think that naturally then entrepreneurs are less likely to be vulnerable because of that historical perception of weakness. And so what I found really interesting about starting my journey is, I mean, Daniela, I was you 10 years ago. If you would have said, Chad, you're going to run your own company one day, I would have said, you have lost your mind. I like collecting my own check too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then I think it came to a point for me personally where the risk of not knowing was greater than kind of staying in my lane and doing, I don't want to call it safe because I don't think it's safe for everyone. Like, I don't think you're being safe, but I think that my gut was pulling me somewhere on a journey. And so the idea of not going on the journey when my gut was telling me to go on that for whatever reason was the risk was, I didn't want to always wonder why or what if.
Did you have like a pivotal moment? Was it over time that you came to this conclusion? Like, you know, how do you go from being what I am today to, you know, having the confidence to be able to go out on your own?
When I was at X Ground Truth, which was XAD at the time, you know, that company grew really, really quickly. You know, I think I was employee like 22 or something. And then, you know, when I was there before I left in 2017, it was like 450 people. And so I think you get addicted to that journey. And when I left there, I wouldn't even say that I left there in the like intentionally thinking I was going to do my own thing eventually, but I did take 6 weeks off and I went to Italy for 16 days, which I highly recommend to anyone listening. But in Italy, I got really drunk in Lake Como, and I was the first 6 days I was by myself, and then I met up with friends. And I called a friend of mine and I said, I'm going to start my own company. And I already had another job to go be a head of sales. But I said, I just feel like something is telling me to do that. And so even in that moment, but I don't know what it was. I just remember calling my friend and saying that.
So what I just learned is that alcohol is very important in your ability and desire to transform.
Yes. If you drink enough wine, everyone will start your own company.
I agree. Just side note, I had very transformational things happen when I was in Italy as well. So there you go.
Well, I also, and I talk about this, and I think I've talked about this on the podcast. I read the book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. And he says, what are you willing to feel pain for? And I thought, if I was to do my own company, like if I didn't do it, it would be because I was afraid, you know, not because it wasn't what I wanted to try and do. And right. So was I willing to walk away from a very comfortable life financially and go back to being on a budget and deplete my savings and all these things that, I mean, if I'm being super vulnerable and transparent, I'm, you know, personally probably poorer than I was in my 30s. You know what I mean? So
yeah, I mean, that's another thing, right? So there's the courage, and I want to talk about that once we bring in our guest. And but the other thing is, you know, there is something I think innate, at least with me, that is like, I'm going to continue to work and I'm going to have a trajectory, if I could speak, in my career. And there's going to be a financial aspect of that that continues to grow. Well, you blew all that up, right?
Well, are you trying to make me drink right now? Like, I think when you believe in something and you can see an opportunity,
it's a passion.
I think that here's the weird thing, Daniela, and I was actually having this conversation with Cam, you know, who runs Diversity, Inclusion, and Belonging at LiveRamp. I told him, I said, I make less money now than I ever have, but I find myself being more generous with even the little money that I pay myself. Like, it has changed my mindset. I think back to that time and how much money I was making and how I was not generous and how I, you know, could have done so much more. And it actually makes me more angry. And I think that, you know, on top of that, you have your company, which you're so personally attached to. And like when other people don't lean in at the level that you would want them to, you know, it's like them calling your baby ugly. You know, people say it all the time, but it really is a personal thing. It is something, it is the number one thing I've had to work on the most is like when someone doesn't believe in my vision out of the gate and I have to convince them that just like to trust that process.
Yeah. So. Interesting.
But I think I think that I want to bring in our next guest because, you know, she is someone that I was introduced to when I started this journey. And immediately was just like so impressed with her on many levels of going on this journey, kind of taking the leap to raising money, doing all this stuff. And we have a similar background. So, you know, she worked in advertising. She was a former art director on brands like CoverGirl. She left the agency world with her co-founder, Claire, to curate teams for nonprofit organizations, but it has, as any idea does, has transformed and morphed into really a platform for the freelance economy so that people who are kind of working individually, and I'll let her tell me if I'm explaining this right, can actually team up in a more automated way and actually be a full person studio. And the company is called Weethos. So really excited to introduce the CEO and co-founder, Rachel Rennick. Welcome, Rachel.
Rachel, yeah, hey. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. Just for the record, I've also been to Lake Como and it's amazing.
So yes.
I get
yes.
it.
Yes. I tell
That's
people
I'm learning.
If I die and go to heaven, or die and go to heaven or hell, I guess I won't know. But like, if I die, spread my ashes all over Lake Como. I say it all the time. So,
oh, yeah.
So I will refrain from talking about that with you, Rachel, because I could go on for hours. So Rachel, look, you know, I know you were kind of listening in on our earlier conversation. Did you always know? So when you were an art director working on CoverGirl and other brands, were you like, one day I'm going to be an entrepreneur?
I don't think I've ever really associated in my brain, like me and then this word of like an entrepreneur. Like, you know, you kind of have this picture of what an entrepreneur is, quote unquote, like the Mark Zuckerberg type of situation. And so I never really thought about myself that way, I guess, specifically, but I did know two things very early on in my career, which was one, I can do this 10 times better if I were not at this giant agency. and then two was I have like a manic obsession with solving problems. So for me, like, it's sort of less about quote unquote starting a company. And it's more like I am relentlessly pursuing this, solving this problem, and the company in and of itself, like, kind of follows that. So that's kind of how I associate with it. I think now, if you know, asking me that question versus 5 years ago, maybe I wouldn't have associated so much with that word. Now I definitely do. And like my girlfriend and I joke all the time that somehow everything is a business in my brain. Like, oh, that should be a business. We're like, we should turn that into a bit. Like, I need to stop telling people's moms to like turn their like things into businesses. So now I feel like I have definitely that kind of like serial entrepreneur mindset. But growing up, or, you know, early on, I didn't necessarily associate myself that way.
But what was the moment? So what was the moment that, you know, you're sitting at Havas and you go, you know what? It's time.
Yeah. So I would say, like, I think it was more like death by a thousand paper cuts, I suppose. So there were a lot of things kind of building up over the course of a couple of years in working in the industry, not even just at that agency specifically, that felt like it wasn't a great fit for me. A couple of those things that pushed me sort of to start my own thing and kind of leave the big agency life, though, was a lot of politics, a lot of red tape, really, really bad lack of diversity that impacted the quality of the work that we were doing, because homogeneous teams are just frankly ill-equipped for innovation. And I also didn't feel like I had sort of the autonomy that I wanted to decide what I work on and when I work and how we actually execute those things. Like, it felt like I was going through like 10 layers of creative directors who were all subjectively basically just ultimately pushing their own ideas through, honestly. So I wanted to kind of cut through that noise. And I think, you know, what really led to my leaving was in 2016, it was the summer of 2016. It was like the height of what we thought would be the height of the political madness till we elected that guy. Jesus. Sorry. So
no apologies.
You know, yeah, you're in company here. Yeah. Like,
but yeah, so anyway, it was like the summer of 2016, and there was also, I was really pretty heavily involved with the Black Lives Matter movement back then. And I remember, you know, Tamir Rice getting shot, holding a BB gun as a 13-year-old child, literally. And I had this moment where I was like up on the ninth floor or something in this giant building in New York, and I saw this huge, huge crowd coming down. I have like chills just even thinking about it. Coming down the West Side Highway, because I was down in Tribeca, and it was Black Lives Matter protest. And I remember like looking around the office, which was pretty kind of empty at that point, looking down at this massive crowd, effectively stopping traffic on the highway. And in that moment, I was like, I need to do something more meaningful. And I walked out of the agency and I joined the protest. And I walked with them all the way up the West Side Highway, up to 14th Street, all the way across Manhattan. And then we had like a sit-in in Herald Square. And it was just such a powerful moment for me as an activist, frankly, and as a creative, because I think creatives ultimately are problem solvers, that I just felt like I needed to have more control over how I was like applying my time and my skills. And that's really what kind of pushed me from there to ultimately leave my job, I think within a couple of months of that moment, to start our own studio and work with organizations that are making an impact.
How did you translate that moment of impact and wanting to do more to the idea of opening your own business and creating kind of the impact that you're having today with nonprofits, with freelance, kind of, how did you draw that, you know, those two together?
Yeah. So at the time I was freelancing a lot on the side for nonprofit organizations. And I was working with a lot of LGBT organizations like that were predominantly focused on getting folks into advertising and media that were part of the community. And I was working with those organizations and they were constantly asking me for more resources. Like they were like, do you know any writers? Do you know any developers? Do you know any this? Do you know any that? And I recognized obviously that there was this massive resourcing disparity in the space. And, you know, the people solving our toughest problems have access to the least amount of talent. The whole dynamic makes no sense.
Yeah.
So I saw a big opportunity there. And all the nonprofit financial information, by the way, is public and online. So I did what any crazy person slash entrepreneur does. And I started with a spreadsheet and I went and I did, you know, the research about spending and I looked at financials. And as it turns out, the nonprofit industry is a massive market. Philanthropy pushes more money around than the venture capital community does, exponentially more. And they're contributing a huge amount to the GDP every year. And there was a big problem there. At the same time, I wasn't the only one in advertising that felt like, oh my God, how many more cars can I sell? How much more chocolate can I sell? You know, like, this is how I spend 40 hours of the week, like making social posts about fucking chocolate. You know, there were a lot of people that felt that way. And so 1 + 1 = 2. And I saw a big opportunity and that's where we left. And we did carve out a really nice wedge into that market. And it all kind of connected for me and pushed me to take the leap.
Was your, so, you know, you kind of tied this around to the political environment when you were first talking. So were you leaned in and an activist? You know, you said you were freelancing for nonprofits. So was this something that was kind of instilled in you as a person, or was that time changing you and like what you focused and valued?
I think it exacerbated it. What really caused me to pay more attention to the impact I was making was when I actually came out, years prior. So came out years prior, suddenly I'm part of an even more marginalized community. You know, I was already a woman, but the LGBT community is widely underrepresented, so on and so forth. And, you know, that level of, oh, like people literally hate me just because I exist, like just for being who I am, obviously just opened up a floodgate of empathy. And I remember, you know, from like the, when I graduated college, like 2013 through up through the political madness in 2016, it was sort of this gradual thing that I got more and more involved. I was reading a lot of Roxane Gay. I was reading a lot about history that I hadn't been taught in my whitewashed public school. And it just kind of grew from there. So that was actually the moment for me, which was a big sort of pathway to creating that empathy that ultimately led to impact.
I so relate with what you said about nonprofits and the way they're scrutinized and the monetary breakdown and all that stuff. Like I could talk about that for hours and how insane it is, how people pick it apart. But the political environment, I think for me was, you know, what was the catalyst? Like until, you know, I say 2016 kind of generally a lot, but I was so asleep at the wheel. Now, listen, I gave monetarily, right? Because, you know, as Danielle and I were talking about in the opening, you know, I was a CRO, I was making decent money. And so I would just like give money where it was needed. And so I don't think that, you know, I wasn't socially aware, but I did it in a way that was super convenient and lazy. You know what I mean? But 2016 was what really said, Chad, you need to wake up and start educating yourself and really start to pay attention. So I was really interested in that.
When I originally quit my job in 2016, I definitely met a lot of entrepreneurs that were pushed by the political environment. I think a lot of people, especially after the election happened, certainly that was the case. Leading up to the election, like I, as well as a lot of people, thought she would win. When she didn't, that exacerbated things. But I think that, you know, I think it's a good thing. Ultimately, I think it's terrible that it took that for all of us to kind of like snap out of it and recognize our own privilege, frankly, because to be even checked out of the political system is a privilege in and of itself. Right. So I think it is ultimately a good thing. But I think we're going through again another wave here in 2020 of people really coming to terms with the reality of our society and the systemic changes that we really need to make.
Is there anything that you have learned along this way? So I'm going to take a step back, actually. So I think I've said this a couple of times, but I think it takes a tremendous amount of courage to do what you have done. I actually have heard, Rachel, as you're talking, that you almost were freed, right? You felt it was a freeing exercise. So is there anything that has transformed? So again, I look at it very much like this is a very courageous act to be able to go out. I look at it as like I'm jumping off of a building without a safety net, right? That's the way that I think about it. Yeah. Talk to me about like what this has done for you. And again, I'm going to go back to that freeing, that sentiment of feeling free to be able to do and make the decisions you want. I would just love to understand and have our listeners understand kind of what the decision to go out on your own has really meant and done for you.
Yeah, it's funny. Like I always joke that to be an entrepreneur, you have to be, it's like a fine line between confident and delusional. Mm. So, you know, it's like
truer words have never been said.
Yeah. Cause you know, to a certain extent, like you're getting told no all the time. I mean, I get told no definitely more than I get told yes. And so to have the confidence to like push through those moments, you need it. But there's also a level of delusion that every entrepreneur I think is slightly afraid of, which is like, am I deluding myself into being like the only person that believes in this and like just kind of bullishly moving forward blindly and not considering that like maybe it's a bad idea or maybe it's whatever. So I think I've always been, you know, definitely a more confident person. My mom was also, you know, had her own business for a while. So I saw that a lot growing up. It didn't seem like such a crazy thing to me, I guess. So it sort of normalized it in a way. Whereas my dad was very much like a, you know, worked his way up the ladder kind of career path. And so it's very different things to be observing. And I honestly went into advertising thinking like I had this goal. I was like, by 26, I want to be making six figures and I want to be creative director. And when I quit my job, I was 25. I was interviewing literally for creative director jobs. And I think I was at like 90K or something. So I was like close to being like, okay, this is like, you know, my aggressive goal for myself when I left college. And then I threw it all away. I left and I basically started over from scratch. I don't know that there's anywhere that courage suddenly sort of like came to be that sort of pushed me over the edge to do it. What I did know is if I was going to fail, I wanted to fail young because I had less to lose. Mm, and
that's great insight.
If the ultimate downside is just that I fail or someone says no, then I really have nothing to lose. You know, like I think sort of this urge or this nagging feeling of like, I have to try at least. I can't not try was so much stronger than the fear of failing. And I also think that just having come from the creative side, you know, I went to art school. Art school is brutal. Like they are mean. And like, talk about thick skin. Like, you know, you make something and then you hold it up and show everybody. And then at art school, they punch it. And that's like what it feels like. And so I was used to that kind of like fail and redo, fail and redo, fail and redo. And so I kind of already had that sort of mindset. So ultimately, I don't think that I am fearless in any way, shape, or form. In fact, I carry a lot of fear all the time. But I think that my sort of urge or tendency to want to solve a problem and to want to see something through and at least like try just kind of far outweighs the fear that also does exist, because I don't think fearless is really a thing.
Well, right. I think any entrepreneur who says that they don't have fears is probably a psychopath or a liar.
Or has a lot like a trust fund safety net.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Which I do not have.
Daddy. So do you find it lonely?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And
same thing. It was the biggest surprise for me of the process. And it's the only word I can think to explain it. And so I'm curious, Rachel, like when does the loneliness come the most when in the process for you?
Yeah. So like there are little moments, then there are big moments. I think little moments, I think about a lot. So things like suddenly I didn't have a ton that I could relate to with my friends. Mm. So like they all were working in mostly, honestly, advertising and media. And suddenly when I started my own company from my couch, like my problems became very different from their problems. So like we used to like sit around and get drinks and like complain about work. Mm-hmm. And when you're complaining about work goes from like, oh my God, my boss was so horrible the other day. And like, I was just a little bit late, blah, 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 to, oh, I pitched 20 investors last week and they all said no.
Right.
you start to feel lonelier and lonelier, and it feels like you have less to relate to people to. And I think like every entrepreneur, at least I am, I don't want to generalize, is like a little bit afraid in the back of their brains of that stereotype of like, my next business will definitely take off. Like the sort of like, you know, whatever, 70-year-old dad is like still trying to get a business going. Yeah. And so when you tell people like, I'm an entrepreneur, or musicians have this too, I'm a musician, there's such a wide range of success in that regard, in that spectrum, that I constantly am feeling like, I was feeling like I have to qualify myself and, oh, I have employees and I did it. It's like, I'm not just, you know, starting a failing business, I've raised money. Like you just kind of feel like you need to qualify yourself. And so anyway, all these little things sort of add up to this feeling of loneliness, because it is hard for people to even ask me about like, how's work? Cause they just don't really know where to start.
Yeah.
Right.
What do you do to combat it? Like, do you guys get together, right? Or do you create a community of other entrepreneurs?
Rachel's my therapist.
Well, I mean, I say it because I would have I would just sit there and be like, yeah, I couldn't do it. So I don't know what you're going through.
Yeah, I definitely other entrepreneurs, like, you know, talking to Chad, talking to other people, and relating to them and opening up to them is huge. Having like a peer group is huge. I have a co-founder who is so wonderful. And in the darkest moments, she has seen me in some really dark moments, and I've seen her in some dark moments. We've both had those, and having somebody there like through that thick and thin is so hard to find. So that's been a huge thing. And I think over time, as I've gotten more confident in myself and in what I'm doing, I feel less of an urge to be so like intense and sort of like qualify everything. And I've been able to open up more, even just in my personal life, of like, you know, half of that battle is that some of those feelings are projected feelings, right? Like yeah. Other people probably don't really feel like that. Like I can't relate to Rachel anymore. Like I don't know that other people actually feel like that. Mm-hmm. So because it maybe is projection, I've tried to just stop doing what I used to do, which is like not really say a lot about it. Oh, it's going well. And then just kind of like immediately try to change the subject. And actually just start really articulating some of the things that I'm experiencing in my day to day. And that has helped as well. Just opening up to other people.
Yeah. Like it's so interesting that you say that, because when I was, you know, I've been home, I'm now back in New York, but I was, you know, home in Arkansas. And so my mom would see me working every day, you know what I mean? And kind of got a firsthand look at things. And I found myself explaining things more to her, where yeah. I think before that I was always just like, oh, she won't understand, you know, or whatever.
Totally.
And so I definitely think it does make it, you're like, here's why this is important and why I need to do this. And, you know, you're kind of explaining the process. But I will say this, Daniela, you know, going back to what Rachel said about being a problem solver, I look at you that way. I think that, you know, that's one of your best, mm-hmm. you know, traits in what you do on a daily basis. So I actually think.
I still like to be paid by somebody else.
Well, there you go. Okay. I'm just saying, you have it in you. I believe in you is all I'm trying to say.
Thank you. Would you consider yourself, it's funny you brought up kind of like a serial entrepreneur, because I do think that that is a very different behavior, right? When you are building something because you believe in it and because you want to build this up into something that is meaningful, right? Versus there's a lot of people out there that are literally, I'm going to start my business. I'm starting it to get it sold. And then I'm going to move on to my next.
Yeah. Right? So I always joke that like, if I wanted to get rich quick, this was just about the worst get rich quick scheme I could have put, statistically speaking, just because the failure rate is insanely high.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Also I'm a woman, and my little woman brain, of course, could never,
never,
could never. So, you know, statistically speaking, I definitely am not a serial entrepreneur in that I'm trying to like flip companies and sell them and like get rich quickly. Maybe I would try to start doing that after this experience, but I think that really what it comes down to is, again, like the problem solver thing. Like, I just can't resist a good problem. And so I could see myself maybe starting something else later if I find a great problem to solve. But ultimately, I've like chosen this problem. I've been fixated on it for 5 years. And this is the thing that I hope and I plan, honestly, to do for the next decade. I also thought about maybe running for office at some point.
Well, that would be really interesting, but I do think that you probably would be a serial, because you think about what you said earlier though, Rachel, where you were like, I'm always finding little companies. Like, I think you would probably naturally find something that you thought you could solve probably quicker than you would think. That would be my hunch. Cause I do the same thing. Like, I think, oh, what is it that person do this? Like, it is weird once you get into that mode. Cause I'm very curious. Did you ever get to a point where you were like, holy shit, I have a company? Like, I found myself kind of do that at one point where I was like, I have 5 employees and we're like actually generating revenue. And, you know, this is actually working. You know what I mean? Like, where it's like, my vision, here it comes. Like, so did you ever get to that point too? Which sounds very confident for any investor listening.
I think I've had like sort of two of those moments. The first moment was after I raised our first round of funding. So when I raised our first round of funding, it was like we closed around about a year after I had quit my job. And like, I went to art school. I didn't even know the difference between an angel investor and a VC when I started the company. And I managed to like trial by fire my way for a year through to raising $1 million. And that is an amount of money that I've never seen in my whole life. I remember like taking a screenshot of it in the bank and like sending it to my mom. And my mom was just like, what is happening?
Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, she's like, what is this world you're living in? And I was like, don't worry about it. I was like, it's real. She's like, are you sure it's not a scam? I literally, when I got my first term sheet, I called my mother and she's like, are you sure it's not a scam? I was like, yes.
That's great.
So, which is like, fair question, mom, fair. Yeah. So I definitely had that moment then, which I think also was a little bit of a mistake, honestly, because fundraising is not the end goal. It's just a means to an end. But because we hype this up so much, like VC and capital and, you know, companies are only written about when they raise a round of funding, I think that entrepreneurs, as I did early on, think that that is the goal. And then you have $1 million and you're like, okay, so this is actually the beginning. And
yeah, that's
now
the
we're
real pressure.
And do the thing. And then that money goes away much faster than it came in, to be honest. So
how
that was like definitely one of those moments.
How do you know what to do? I'm just going to say this, because I think about all of these ideas that I could start a business on. And then I sit there and go, I have absolutely no idea how to get started, who to contact, or what to do. And I'm surrounded by entrepreneurs and I still have no idea.
Yeah.
So how do you know what to do?
For me, like every idea starts with a deck. Every company I think ever has started with like a deck or a spreadsheet. And ultimately, the very first thing that I wanted to do when I had the idea, you know, digging into the nonprofit financials, all that came from a place of like validating whether or not this was going to be viable. So it's a constant like moving target of validating, do people want this? Is there demand? Do people want this? Is there demand? And when we were doing all that research, we put up like a splash page Squarespace site. It was a wait list. It was like, we're doing this thing. We're going to match freelancers, nonprofits. Give us your email if you're interested. We put that in a New York City ad jobs Facebook network group. We got like 300 signups overnight. We were like, demand, boom. And like, that's, so for me, getting started usually starts with a customer and the demand. And then, okay, 300 signups. All right, now let's go start talking to people. Let's dig into what the actual problems are and then coming up with like the solution to do that. But I think being able to cohesively like write down your idea of like, what is that problem that you're trying to solve and who is it for, is usually the place that I start. And then honestly, my co-founder, Claire, is like, God bless her. Because I'm like, okay, we're at point A. We need to get to point B. Here's the vision. And Claire's like, great. Here's how we're going to execute. Here's a timeline. Here's the blah, blah, blah. And so she really does bring that to the table. And I think that combination is super, super powerful.
Rachel, I just want to wrap up with asking this last question. What do you miss most about not being a founder?
Oh, yeah. I loved this. I think the thing that comes to mind, because people have asked me this question before, immediately is like, I really miss in my old job when I could just like come in on a Monday and like just chill a little bit. Like I miss being able to like be more passive in meetings, like not really paying attention, doodling. Like I just miss this, that like more passive energy that most of the time made me kind of bored. But there were moments where like today with my job, like if I don't feel up to it, if I'm not feeling it that day, like too bad for me, because there's no one else that can do what I'm doing. And unlike when I was working in a big company, you know, strolling in with a nice coffee and chilling for the first half of a Monday, like I miss that. Now I'm like the all hands meeting, metrics, rah. And it's just like, you know, my week is so crazy. So I definitely miss that. I miss that there is like lower periods, I guess, and less riding on every single little decision and things.
You got to think that every decision in my world is not mine to fix, or every issue or every problem is not mine to fix or address. You can't say that, right?
Yeah, not really. Like right now, so I have like 14 full-time employees currently, and I'm actually continuing to learn a lot about myself and them, that how the people you hire solve the problems is more of a reflection of you as a CEO than how you would solve those problems. So like, there are certain things that only I can do, and there are certain moments that I definitely have that I bring those strengths to the table, but ultimately, you're actually totally right, even in the context of my job, of like, not every problem is mine to solve. And the best sentence I've learned as a CEO is, you'll figure it out. Okay, sure. Yeah, okay. Ask a couple of good questions, make them think about something a little bit more deeply. And then, all right, well, I trust that you'll figure it out. Let me know where you net out. And like that, letting go of that control, like not being the one that is constantly trying to solve the problem, is both terrifying, but it's really, really empowering. And it feels really good to have a team under me that I can trust, and that I know will come to the table with a great solution, even if it's maybe not the exact solution that I would have had in my head.
I'm so going to use that from now on. If Susu's listening in on this, she's probably like, oh hell, but she figures it out anyway. So she doesn't care. She's already got the qualities.
You'll figure it out.
That's right.
I trust you. You'll figure it out.
And that's like, right. Okay. Anyway, I'm going to go back to having my coffee and phoning it in. No, I'm just kidding. This has been so great. I mean, Rachel, you're somebody that obviously I've admired for now several years. I think we've known each other for a couple of years, and I learned so much from you, and I just really appreciate you taking the time to be our guest.
Thanks, Chad. I've learned a lot from you too, honestly. And I will just say, if anybody out there is like thinking about taking the leap or is just taking the leap, patience is a virtue. Mm-hmm. Be patient with the process. Be patient with yourself. Be as patient with yourself as you are with other people, because I tend to overcorrect on one of those. And just keep going. That's it. You know, that's what it comes down to.
Very inspiring.
Love it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Rachel, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for joining this episode of Conversations on Purpose.
To learn more about upcoming episodes, subscribe to Conversations on Purpose on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.